Guy with the fighting fish scrambles up and starts to do things with wires and consoles. And Mona could just watch, because she was so still. And it was all interesting stuff. How the big guy gives this bellow and rushes over, shouting how they're his, they're his. How the face on the screen says, "Slick, come on, you don't need him anymore." Then this engine starts up, somewhere downstairs. And Mona hears this clanking and rattling, and then somebody yelling, down there. And the sun's coming in the tall, skinny window now, so she moves over there to look. And there's something out there, kind of a truck or hover, only it's buried under this pile of what looks like refrigerators. Brand new refrigerators, and broken hunks of plastic crates. And there's somebody in a camo suit lying down with his face in the snow. And out past that, there's another hover, looks like it's all burned up. It's interesting. Chapter 40. Pink Satin. Angela Mitchell comprehends this room and its inhabitants through shifting data planes that represent viewpoints. Though of whom or what, she is in most cases in doubt. There is a considerable degree of overlap, of contradiction. The man with the ragged crest of hair, in black beaded leather, is Thomas Trail Gentry. As birth data and SIN digits cascade through her, of no fixed address, as a different facet informs her that this room is his. Past a gray wash of official data traces, faintly marbled with the fission authorities' repeated pink suspicions of utilities fraud, she finds him in a different light. He is like one of Bobby's cowboys. Though young, he is like the old man of the Gentleman Loser. He is an autodidact, an eccentric, obsessed by his own lights, a scholar. He is mad, a night runner, guilty, in Mama's view, in Legbas, of manifold heresies. Lady Three Jane, in her own eccentric scheme, has filed him under Rambeau. Another face flares out at Angie from Rambeau. His name is Riviera, a minor player in the dreams. Molly has deliberately stunned him, causing an explosive flechette to detonate 18 centimeters from his skull. Molly, like the girl Mona, is sinless, her birth unregistered, yet around her name, names, swarm galaxies of supposition, rumor, conflicting data. Street girl, prostitute, bodyguard, assassin. She mingles on the manifold planes with the shadows of heroes and villains whose names mean nothing to Angie, though their residual images have long since been woven through the global culture. And this, too, belonged to Three Jane, and now belongs to Angie. Molly has just killed a man, has fired one of the explosive flechettes into his throat. His collapse against a steel railing, suffering metal fatigue, has caused a large section of catwalk to tumble to the floor below. This room has no other entrance, a fact of some strategic importance. It was probably not Molly's intention to cause the collapse of the catwalk. She sought to prevent the man, a hired mercenary, from using his weapon of choice, a short alloy shotgun, coated with a black non-reflective finish. Nonetheless, Gentry's loft is now effectively isolated. Angie understands Molly's importance to Three Jane, the source of her desire for and rage at her. Knowing this, she sees all the banality of human evil. Angie sees Molly restlessly prowling a gray winter London, a young girl at her side, and knows, without knowing how she knows, that this same girl is now at 23 Margate Road, SW2. Continuity. The girl's father was previously the master of the man Swain, who had lately become Three Jane's servant, for the sake of the information she provides to those who do her bidding. As has Robin Lanier, of course, though he waits to be paid in a different coin. For the girl Mona, Angie feels a peculiar tenderness, a pity, a degree of envy, though Mona has been altered to resemble Angie as closely as possible. Mona's life has left virtually no trace on the fabric of things, and represents, in Legba's system, the nearest thing to innocence. Cherry Lee Chesterfield is surrounded by a sad, ragged scrawl. Her information profile, like a child's drawing. Citations for vagrancy, petty debts, and a bordered career as a paramedical technician, grade 6. Framing birth data and sin. Slick, or Slick Henry, is among the sinless. But 3-Jane, Continuity, Bobby, all have lavished their attention on him. For 3-Jane, he serves as the focus of a minor node of association. She equates his ongoing rite of construction, his cathartic response to chemo-penal trauma, with her own failed attempts to exorcise the barren dream of Tessier Ashpool. In the corridors of 3-Jane's memory, Angie has frequently come upon the chamber where a spider-armed manipulator stirs the refuse of Straylight's brief clotted history, an act of extended collage. And Bobby provides other memories, tapped from the artist as he accessed 3-Jane's library of babble. His slow, sad, childlike labor on the plane called Dog Solitude, erecting anew the forms of pain and memory. Down in the chill dark of factory's floor, one of Slick's kinetic sculptures, controlled by a sub-program of Bobby's, removes the left arm of another mercenary, employing a mechanism salvaged 2 summers before from a harvesting machine of Chinese manufacture. The mercenary, whose name and sin boil past Angie like hot silver bubbles, dies with his cheek against one of Little Bird's boots. Only Bobby, of all the people in this room, is not here as Data. And Bobby is not the wasted thing before her, strapped down in alloy and nylon, its chin filmed with dried vomit. Nor the eager familiar face gazing out at her from a monitor on Gentry's workbench. Is Bobby the solid, rectangular mass of memory bolted above the stretcher? Now she steps across rolling dunes of soiled pink satin, under a tooled steel sky, free at last of the room and its data. Brigitte walks beside her, and there is no pressure, no hollow of night, no hive sound. There are no candles. Continuity is there, too, represented by a strolling scribble of silver tinsel that reminds her somehow of Hilton Swift on the beach at Malibu. "Feeling better?" Brigitte asks. "Much better, thank you." "I thought so. Why is Continuity here?" "Because he is your cousin, built from mass biochips. Because he is young. We walk with you to your wedding." "But who are you, Brigitte? What are you, really?" "I am the message your father was told to write. I am the veve he drew in your head." Brigitte leans close. "Be kind to Continuity. He fears that in his clumsiness, he has earned your displeasure." The tinsel scribble scoots off before them, across the satin dunes, to announce the bride's arrival. Chapter 41. Mr. Yanaka. The Moss Neotech unit was still warm to the touch. The white plastic pad beneath it was discolored, as if by heat. A smell like burning hair. She watched the bruises on Tick's face darken. He'd sent her to a bedside cabinet for a worn tin cigarette box filled with pills and derma discs, had torn his collar open and pressed 3 of the adhesive discs against skin white as porcelain. She helped him fashion a sling from a length of optic cable.
"But Colin said she had forgotten, I haven't, he said,
and sucked air between his teeth, working the sling beneath his arm.
Seemed to happen at the time. Lingers a bit.
He winced.
I'm sorry.
It's okay. Sally told me. About your mother, I mean.
Yes.
She didn't look away.
She killed herself. In Tokyo.
Whoever she was, that wasn't her.
The unit.
She glanced toward the breakfast table.
She burnt it. Won't matter to him, though. He's still there. Has the run of it. What's our Sally up to, then?
She has Angela Mitchell with her. She's gone to find a thing that all that comes from. Where we were. A place called New Jersey.
The telephone rang. Kumiko's father, head and shoulders, on the broad screen behind Tick's telephone. He wore his dark suit, his Rolex watch, a galaxy of small fraternal devices in his lapel. Kumiko thought he looked very tired, tired and very serious, a serious man behind the smooth dark expanse of desk in his study. Seeing him there, she regretted that Sally hadn't phoned from a booth with a camera. She would very much have liked to see Sally again. Now, perhaps it would be impossible.
You look well, Kumiko,
her father said. Kumiko sat up very straight, facing the small camera mounted just below the wall screen. In reflex, she summoned her mother's mask of disdain. But it would not come. Confused, she dropped her gaze to where her hands lay folded in her lap. She was abruptly aware of Tick, of his embarrassment, his fear, trapped in the chair beside her, in full view of the camera.
You were correct to flee Swain's house, her father said.
She met his eyes again.
He is your kobun.
No longer. While we were distracted here with our own difficulties, he formed new and dubious alliances, pursuing courses of which we could not approve.
And your difficulties, father?
Was there the flicker of a smile?
All that is ended. Order and accord are again established.
Excuse me, sir, Mr. Yanaka.
Tick began, then seemed to lose his voice altogether.
Yes. And you are?
Tick's bruised face contorted in a huge and particularly lugubrious wink.
His name is Tick, father. He has sheltered and protected me. Along with Carl, with the Mass Neotech unit, he saved my life tonight.
Really? I had not been informed of this. I was under the impression that you had not left his apartment.
Something called.
How?
She asked, sitting forward.
How could you know?
The Mass Neotech unit broadcast your destination once it was known. Once the unit was clear of Swain's systems. We dispatched watchers to the area.
She remembered the noodle seller.
Without, of course, informing Swain. But the unit never broadcast a second message.
It was broken. An accident.
Yet you say it saved your life.
Sir,
Tick said,
you'll pardon me. What I mean is, am I covered?
Covered?
Protected. From Swain, I mean, and his bent SB friends in the wrist.
Swain is dead.
There was a silence.
But somebody will be running it, surely. The fancy, I mean, your business.
Mr. Yanaka regarded Tick with frank curiosity.
Of course.
How else might order and accord be expected to continue?
Give him your word, father,
Kumiko said,
that he will come to no harm.
Yanaka looked from Kumiko to the grimacing Tik.
I extend profound gratitude to you, sir, for having protected my daughter. I am in your debt.
Giri,
Kumiko said.
Christ,
Tik said, overcome with awe.
Fucking fancy that.
Father,
Kumiko said,
on the night of my mother's death, did you order the secretaries to allow her to leave alone?
Her father's face was very still. She watched it fill with a sorrow she had never before seen.
No, he said at last. I did not.
Tik coughed.
Thank you, Father. Will I be returning to Tokyo now?
Certainly, if you wish. Though I understand you have been allowed to see very little of London. My associate will soon arrive at Mr. Tik's apartment. If you wish to remain to explore the city, he will arrange this.
Thank you, Father.
Goodbye, Kumi.
And he was gone.
Now then,
Tik said, wincing horribly as he extended his good arm.
Help me up from this.
But you require medical attention.
Don't I, then?
He'd managed to get to his feet and was hobbling toward the toilet when Petal opened the door from the dark upstairs hall.
If you've broken my bloody lock,
Tik said,
you'd better pay me for it.
Sorry, Petal said, blinking. I've come for Miss Yanaka.
Too bad, mate. Just had her dad on the phone. Told us Swain's been topped. Told us he's sending round the new boss.
He smiled crookedly, triumphantly.
But you see,
Petal said gently,
that's me.
Chapter 42. Factory Floor. Cherries still screaming. Somebody shut her up, Molly says. Where she's standing by the door with her little gun, and Mona thinks she can do that, can pass Cherry a little of her stillness, where everything's interesting and nothing's pushing too hard. But on the way across the room, she sees the crumpled Ziploc on the floor and remembers there's a derm in there. Maybe something that'll help Cherry calm down.
Here,
she says when she gets to her, peels the backing off and sticks the derm on the side of Cherry's neck. Cherry's scream slides down the scale into a gurgle as she sinks down the face of old books. But Mona's sure she'll be okay. And anyway, there's shooting downstairs. Guns. Out past Molly, a white tracer goes racketing and wanging around steel girders. And Molly's yelling at Gentry, can he turn the goddamn lights on? That had to mean the lights downstairs, because the lights up here were plenty bright. So bright, she can see fuzzy little beads, traces of color, streaming off things if she looks close. Tracers. That's what you call those bullets, the ones that light up. Eddie told her that in Florida, looking down the beach to where some private security was shooting them off in the dark.
Yeah, lights,
the face on the little screen said. The witch can't see. Mona smiled at him. She didn't think anybody else had heard. Witch. So Gentry and Big Slick were tearing around yanking these fat yellow wires off the wall where they'd been stuck with silver tape and plugging them together with these metal boxes. And Cherry from Cleveland was sitting on the floor with her eyes closed. And Molly was crouched down by the door holding her gun with both hands. And Angie was...
Be still.
She heard somebody say that. But it was nobody in the room. She thought maybe it was Lynette. Like Lynette could just say that through time, through the stillness. Because Angie was just there, down on the floor beside the dead guy's stretcher,
her legs folded under her like a statue, her arms around him. The lights dimmed when Gentry and Slick found their connection, and she thought she heard the face on the monitor gasp. But she was already moving toward Angie, seeing, suddenly, totally, so clearly it hurt, the fine line of blood from her left ear. Even then, the stillness held, though already she could feel raw hot points in the back of her throat, and remember Lynette explaining, "You don't ever snort this. It eats holes in you." And Molly's back was straight, her arms stretched out, straight out and down, not to that gray box, but to her pistol, that little thing, and Mona heard it go snick, 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 and then three explosions far off down there, and they must have been blue flashes, but Mona's hands were around Angie now, wrists brushed by blood-smeared fur. To look into gone eyes, the light already fading. Just a long, longest way away.
"Hey,"
Mona said. Nobody to hear. Just Angie toppling across the corpse in the sleeping bag.
"Hey."
She glanced up in time to catch a last image on that viv screen and see it fade. After that, for a long time, nothing mattered. It wasn't like the not caring of the stillness, the crystal overdrive. And it wasn't like crashing. Just this past it feeling. The way maybe a ghost feels. She stood beside Slick and Molly in the doorway and looked down. In the dim glare of big old bulbs, she watched a metal spider thing jittering across the dirty concrete floor. It had big curved blades that snapped and whirled when it moved, but there was nobody in there moving, and the thing just went like a broken toy, back and forth in front of the twisted wreck of the little bridge she'd crossed with Angie and Cherry. Cherry had gotten up from the floor, pale and slack-faced, and peeled the derm from her neck.
"That's mage muscle relaxant," she managed.
And Mona felt bad because she knew she'd done something stupid when she thought she was trying to help, but Wiz always did that. And how come she couldn't stop doing it? "Because you're wired stupid," she heard Lynette say, but she hadn't wanted to remember that. So they all just stood there, looking down at the metal spider twitching and running itself down. All except Gentry, who was unscrewing the gray box from its frame over the stretcher, his black boots beside Angie's red fur. "Listen," Molly said. "That's a copter. Big one." She was the last one down the rope, except for Gentry, and he just said he wasn't coming, didn't care, he'd stay. The rope was fat and dirty gray and had knots tied in it to hang on to, like a swing she'd remembered from a long time ago. Slick and Molly had lowered the gray box first, down to a platform where the metal stairs weren't wrecked. Then Molly went down it like a squirrel, seeming barely to hang on at all, and tied it tight to a railing. Slick went down slowly because he had Cherry over his shoulder, and she was still too relaxed to make it down herself. Mona still felt bad about that, and wondered if that was why they decided to leave her there. It was Molly who decided, though, standing there by that window, watching people pop out of the long black helicopter and spread out across the snow. "Look at that," Molly said. "They know. Just come to pick up the pieces. SenseNet. My ass is out of here." Cherry slurred that they were leaving too, she and Slick. And Slick shrugged, then grinned and put his arm around her.
"What about me?"
Molly looked at her, or seemed to. Couldn't really tell with the glasses. White tooth showed against her lower lip for just a second. Then she said,
"You stay, my advice. Let them sort it out. You haven't really done anything.
None of it was your idea. Think they'll probably do right by you. Or try to.
Yeah.
You stay. It didn't make any sense to Mona, but now she felt so dead, so crash sick, she couldn't argue. And then they were just gone. Down the rope and gone. And it was just like that. How people left and you did never see them anymore. She looked back into the room and saw Gentry pacing back and forth in front of his books, running the tip of his finger along them like he was looking for a special one. He'd thrown a blanket over the stretcher. So she just left. And she wouldn't know if Gentry ever found his book or not. But that was how it was. So she climbed down the rope herself, which wasn't as easy as Molly and Slick had made it look, particularly if you felt like Mona did, because Mona felt close to blacking out, and her arms and legs didn't seem to be working real good anyway. She had to sort of concentrate on making them move, and her nose and throat were swelling inside, so she didn't notice the black guy until she was all the way down. He was standing down there looking at the big spider thing, which wasn't moving at all. Looked up when the heel of her shoe grated across the steel platform. And something so sad about his face when he saw her. But then it was gone, and he was climbing the metal stairs, slow and easy. And as he got closer, she began to wonder if he really was black. Not just the color, which he definitely was, but there was something about the shape of his bald skull, the angles of his face, not quite like anybody she'd seen before. He was tall, real tall, wore a long black coat, leather so thin it moved like silk.
"Hello, missy,"
he said, when he stood in front of her, reached out to raise her chin so she was looking straight into gold-flecked agate eyes like nobody in the world ever had. Long fingers so light against her chin.
"Missy," he said, "how old are you?"
16.
"You need a haircut,"
he said. And there was something so serious about how he said it.
"Angie's up there,"
she said, pointing when she found her voice again.
"She's..."
"Hush."
She heard metal noises far away in the big old building, and then a motor starting up. The hover, she thought, the one Molly'd driven here. The black man raised his eyebrows, except he didn't have any eyebrows.
"Friends?"
He lowered his hand. She nodded.
"Good enough,"
he said, and took her hand to help her down the stairs. At the bottom, still holding her hand, he led her around the wreck of the catwalk thing. Somebody was dead there. Camo material and one of those big voice things like cops have.
"Swift!"
the black man called, out across that whole tall hollow space, between the black grids of windows without any glass, black lines against the white sky. Winter morning.
"Get your ass over here. I found her."
"But I'm not her."
And over there, where the big door stood open, against the sky and snow and rust, she saw this suit come walking, with his coat open and his tie flapping in the wind. And Molly's hover swung past him, out those same doors, and he wasn't even looking, because he was looking at Mona.
"I'm not Angie," she said, and wondered if she ought to tell him what she'd seen. Angie and the young guy together on that little screen, just before it faded.
"I know," the black man said. "But it grows on you."
"Rapture! Rapture's coming!"
Chapter 43. Judge. The woman led them to a hovercraft parked inside factory,
if you could call it parking when the front end was mashed up around a concrete tool mount. It was a white cargo job with Cathode Cafe lettered across the rear doors, and Slick wondered when she'd managed to get it in there without him hearing it. Maybe while Bobby the Count was pulling his diversion with the blimp. The Aleph was heavy, like trying to carry a small engine block. He didn't want to look at the witch, because there was blood on her blades, and he hadn't made her for that. There were a couple of bodies around, or parts of them. He didn't look at that either. He looked down at the block of Biosoft and its battery pack and wondered if all that was still in there. The gray house and Mexico and three Jane's eyes. "Wait," the woman said. They were passing the ramp to the room where he kept his machines. The judge was still there, the corpse grinder. She still had her gun in her hand. Slick put his hand on Cherry's shoulder. She said, "Wait." "That thing I saw last night," the woman said. "One-armed robot?" "That work?"
"Yeah."
"Strong? Carry a load over rough ground?"
"Yeah."
"Get it."
"Huh?"
"Get it into the back of the hover now. Move." Cherry clung to him, weak-kneed from whatever it was that girl had given her. "You." Molly gestured toward her with the gun. "Into the hover."
"Go on,"
Slick said. He set the Aleph down and walked up the ramp and into the room where the judge was waiting in the shadows, the arm beside it on the tarp where Slick had left it. Now he wouldn't ever get it right, how the saw was supposed to work. There was a control unit there on a row of dusty metal shelves. He picked it up and let the judge power up, the brown carapace trembling slightly. He moved the judge forward, down the ramp, the broad feet coming down 1-2, 1-2, the gyros compensating, perfecting for the missing arm. The woman had the rear doors of the hover open, ready, and Slick marched the judge straight over to her. She fell back slightly as the judge towered over her, her silver glasses reflecting polished rust. Slick came up behind the judge and started figuring the angles, how to get him in there. It didn't make sense, but at least she seemed to have some idea of what they were doing, and anything was better than hanging around factory now, with dead people all over. He thought about Gentry, up there with his books and those bodies. There'd been two girls up there, and they'd both looked like Angie Mitchell. Now one of them was dead. He didn't know how or why, and the woman with the gun had told the other one to wait. "Come on, come on, get the fucking thing in, we gotta go." When he'd managed to work the judge into the back of the hover, legs bent on its side, he slammed the doors, ran around, and climbed in on the passenger side. The Aleph was between the front seats. Cherry was curled in the back seat, under a big orange parka with the SenseNet logo on the sleeve, shivering. The woman fired up the turbine and inflated the bag. Slick thought they might be hung on the tool mount, but when she reversed, it tore away a strip of chrome and they were free. She swung the hover around and headed for the gates. On the way out, they passed a guy in a suit and tie and a tweed overcoat, who didn't seem to see them.
"Who's that?"
She shrugged. "You want this hover?" she asked. They were maybe 10 kilos from factory now, and he hadn't looked back.
"You steal it?"
"Sure."
"I'll pass."
"Yeah?
I did time. Car theft."
"So how's your girlfriend?"
"Asleep. She's not my girlfriend."
"No?"
"I get to ask who you are?"
"A businesswoman."
"What business?"
"Hard to say." The sky above the solitude was bright and white.
"You come for this?"
He tapped the aleph. Sort of.
What now?
I made a deal. I got Mitchell together with the box.
That was her, the one who fell over?
Yeah, that was her.
But she died.
There's dying. Then there's dying.
Like 3 Jane.
Her head moved, like she'd glanced at him. What do you know about that?
I saw her once. In there.
Well, she's still in there. But so's Angie.
And Bobby.
Newmark? Yeah.
So, what'll you do with it?
You built those things, right? One in the back, the others.
Slick glanced back over his shoulder to where the judge was folded in the hover's cargo space, like a big, rusty, headless doll.
Yeah.
So you're good with tools?
Guess so.
Okay. I got a job for you.
She slowed the hover beside a ragged crest of snow-covered scrap and coasted to a halt.
There'll be an emergency kit in here somewhere. Get it, get up on the roof, get me the solar cells and some wire. I want you to rig the cells so they'll recharge this thing's battery. Can you do that?
Probably, why?
She sank back in the seat and Slick saw that she was older than he'd thought, and tired.
Mitchell's in there now. They want her to have some time is all.
They?
I don't know. Something.
Whatever I cut my deal with.
How long do you figure the battery'll hold out if the cells work?
Couple months. Year, maybe.
Okay. I'll hide it somewhere.
Where the cells can get the sun.
What happens if you just cut the power?
She reached down and ran the tip of her index finger along the thin cable that connected the aleph to the battery. Slick saw her fingernails in the morning light. They looked artificial.
Hey, 3 Jane, she said,
her finger poised above the cable.
I gotcha.
Then her hand was a fist, which opened, as though she were letting something go. Cherry wanted to tell Slick everything they were going to do when they got to Cleveland. He was lashing 2 of the flat cells to the judge's broad chest with silver tape. The gray aleph was already fastened to the machine's back with a harness of tape. Cherry said she knew where she could get him a job fixing rides in an arcade. He wasn't really listening. When he'd gotten it all together, he handed the control unit to the woman.
Guess we wait for you now.
No, she said.
You go to Cleveland.
Cherry just told you.
What about you?
I'm going for a walk.
You want to freeze? Maybe want to starve?
Want to be by my fucking self for a change.
She tried the controls and the judge trembled, took a step forward. Another. Good luck in Cleveland. They watched her walk out across the solitude, the judge clumping along behind her. Then she turned and yelled back,
Hey, Cherry! Get that guy to take a bath!
Cherry waved, the zippers of her leather jackets jingling. Chapter 44 Red Leather. Petals said that her bags were waiting in the Jaguar.
You won't want to be coming back to Notting Hill, he said. So we've arranged something for you in Camden Town.
Petal, she said, I have to know what has happened to Sally.
He started the engine.
Swain was blackmailing her, forcing her to kidnap.
Ah, well then, he interrupted.
I see. Shouldn't worry if I were you.
I am worried.
Sally, I would say, has managed to extricate herself from that little matter. She's also, according to certain official friends of ours, managed to cause all record of herself to evaporate, apparently, except for a controlling interest in a German casino. And if anything's happened to Angela Mitchell, SenseNet hasn't gone public with it. All of that is done with now.
Will I see her again?
Not on my parish. Please.
They pulled away from the curb.
Petal,
she said as they drove through London.
My father told me that Swain...
Fool. Bloody fool. Rather not talk about it now.
I'm sorry.
The heater was working. It was warm in the Jaguar, and Kumiko was very tired now. She settled back against red leather and closed her eyes. Somehow, she thought, her meeting with 3Jane had freed her of her shame, and her father's answer of her anger. 3Jane had been very cruel. Now she saw her mother's cruelty as well. But all must be forgiven. One day, she thought, and fell asleep on the way to a place called Camden Town. Chapter 45 Smooth Stone Beyond. They have come to live in this house. Walls of gray stone, roof of slate, in a season of early summer. The grounds are bright and wild, though the long grass does not grow and the wildflowers do not fade. Behind the house are outbuildings, unopened, unexplored, and a field where tethered gliders strain against the wind. Once, walking alone among the oaks at the edge of that field, she saw 3 strangers, astride something approximately resembling a horse. Horses are extinct. Their line terminated years before Angie's birth. A slim, tweed-coated figure was in the saddle. A boy like a groom from some old painting. In front of him, a young girl, Japanese, straddled the horse thing, while behind him sat a pale, greasy-looking little man in a gray suit, pink socks and white ankles showing above his brown shoes. Had the girl seen her? Returned her gaze? She has forgotten to mention this to Bobby. Their most frequent visitors arrive in dawn dreams, though once a grinning little kobold of a man announced himself by thumping repeatedly on the heavy oak door, demanding, when she ran to open it, "That little shit Newmark!" Bobby introduced this creature as the Finn, and seemed delighted to see him. The Finn's decrepit jacket exuded a complex odor of stale smoke, ancient solder, and pickled herring. Bobby explained that the Finn was always welcome. Might as well be. No way to keep him out once he wants in. 3Jane comes as well. One of the dawn visitors. Her presence sad and tentative. Bobby seems scarcely aware of her. But Angie, the repository of so many of her memories, resonates to that particular mingling of longing, jealousy, frustration, and rage. Angie has come to understand 3Jane's motives, and to forgive her. Though what exactly, wandering amid these oaks and sunlight, is there to forgive? But dreams of 3Jane sometimes weary Angie. She prefers other dreams, particularly those of her young protege. These often come as the lace curtains billow, as a first bird calls. She rolls closer to Bobby, closes her eyes, forms the name continuity in her mind, and waits for the small bright images. She sees that they have taken the girl to a clinic in Jamaica to treat her addiction to crude stimulants.
Her metabolism, fine-tuned by a patient army of net medics, she emerges at last, radiant with health. With her sensorium expertly modulated by Piper Hill, her first stims are greeted with unprecedented enthusiasm. Her global audience is entranced by her freshness, her vigor, the delightfully ingenuous way in which she seems to discover her glamorous life, as if for the first time. A shadow sometimes crosses the distant screen, but only for an instant. Robin Lanier has been found strangled, frozen on the mountainscaped facade of the new Suzuki Envoy. Both Angie and Continuity know whose long, strong hands throttled the star and threw him there. But a certain thing eludes her. One special fragment of the puzzle that is history. At the edge of Oak Shadow, beneath a steel and salmon sunset, in this France that isn't France, she asks Bobby for the answer to her final question. They waited in the drive at midnight, because Bobby had promised her an answer. As the clocks in the house struck 12, she heard the hiss of tires over gravel. The car was long, low, and gray. Its driver was the Finn. Bobby opened the door and helped her in. In the back seat sat the young man she recalled from her glimpse of the impossible horse and its three mismatched riders. He smiled at her but said nothing. "This is Colin," Bobby said, climbing in beside her. "And you know the Finn."
"She never guessed, huh?"
the Finn asked, putting the car in gear. "No," Bobby said. "I don't think so." The young man named Colin was smiling at her.
"The Aleph is an approximation of the Matrix," she said, "a sort of model of cyberspace." "Yes, I know."
She turned to Bobby.
"Well, you promised you'd tell me the why of when it changed."
The Finn laughed, a very strange sound.
"Ain't a why, lady. More like it's a what. Remember one time Brigitte told you there was this other? Yeah? Well, that's the what. And the what's the why."
"I do remember. She said that when the Matrix finally knew itself, there was the other."
"That's where we're going tonight," Bobby began, putting his arm around her. "It isn't far, but it's
different," the Finn said. "It's real different."
"But what is it?"
"You see," Colin said, brushing aside his brown forelock, a gesture like a schoolboy's in some antique play, "when the Matrix attained sentience, it simultaneously became aware of another Matrix, another sentience."
"I don't understand," she said. "If cyberspace consists of the sum total of data in the human system..."
"Yeah," the Finn said, turning out into the long, straight, empty highway. "But nobody's talking human, see?"
"The other one was somewhere else," Bobby said.
"Centauri,"
Colin said. "Can they be teasing her? Is this some joke of Bobby's?"
"So it's kinda hard to explain why the Matrix split up into all those hoodoos and shit when it met this other one,"
the Finn said.
"But when we get there, you'll sorta get the idea."
"My own feeling," Colin said, "is that it's all so much more amusing this way." "Are you telling me the truth?"
"Be there in a New York minute," said the Finn. "No shit."
This has been an Audible Frontiers production. Executive producer, Steve Feldberg. Producer, Mike Charzik. Production Coordinator, Kat Lambrix. Music by Michael Whalen. Copyright 1988 by William Gibson. Audio recording copyright 2009 by Audible Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.